let's continue our meeting. Talk about goodwill and impairment. I give the floor to Michelle.
Good morning. The objective of today's meeting is to discuss the two topics assessed as highly significant in the post-implementation review of IFRS 3, and that's improving the impairment test and also subsequent accounting for goodwill. At the joint meeting in September, we agreed that because the FASB are quite advanced in discussing their related projects, that we needed a few ISB-only meetings to develop our views before discussing them further with the FASB. And at the next ISB meeting in November, we intend to bring a paper on the third interrelated topic, which is the separate measurement of intangible assets in a business combination. Now, until we've discussed all three of these topics, we don't think we can form a view on the appropriate due process document to work towards in this project. So we're not asking ISB members today to have an exposure draft discussion paper discussion at this meeting. And we're also not asking ISB members to make any formal decisions today on these two topics, because we think the aim is just to have an initial discussion on the two topics to perhaps see whether board members have any preliminary views or leanings, and also see if any of the approaches can be ruled out at this stage. And probably most importantly, to see if ISB members need any further information before forming preliminary views on the topics, and also before discussing the topics further with the FASB. So if I start with agenda paper 18A, the staff have analysed four approaches for subsequent accounting for goodwill in the paper, and that is amortisation, accounting for the separate components of goodwill, direct write-off of goodwill, and the fourth approach only focusing on the impairment test, improving the impairment test. The staff have noticed our preference for approach four, because we think if we sufficiently improve and simplify the impairment test, this could mitigate the need to make other changes to the accounting for goodwill. However, we think the ISB should discuss approaches 1, 3 and 4 at a joint meeting with the FASB. These are all approaches that the FASB are considering, so with a view to maintaining convergence. And the staff are not recommending that we pursue approach 2, which is accounting for the separate components of goodwill, further. So do ISB members have any views on the approaches in the paper at this stage, or think they need any further information before developing views?
Thank you. I think it's too early to put the approach 2 and approach 3 off the table. So you are saying that you are going to put the approach 2 off the table. But I think the combination with approach 3 and approach 2 could be the best way for moving ahead. And the reason why I'm saying is that in this project, I think discipline or rigor is most important issue we have to address. Because if you look at the current market, the amount of the merger and acquisition is getting bigger and bigger. And it is a good thing. However, we could call it a bubble. Then when the bubble bursted, I don't think I can protect our standard, if we were criticized like this. I can't protect my current accounting standard. This is because current standards do not have a self-policing mechanism at all. Rather, it has a kind of incentive to the moral hazard. The reason why I'm saying is in the current standard, unless you prove that the existence of intangible asset with finite life, then everything goes to something like goodwill or indefinite intangibles. Then if you do nothing, then you don't have to recognize any loss. So if you don't want a loss, then just doing nothing. So it's a kind of good, bad incentive. You're saying that there isn't any obvious overpayment, but I disagree with it. Some management pays money knowing that this is overpayment, because they just want immediate profit. So I don't think, I'm not saying all the management, but some management do that. So we need to address to this kind of mechanism. So therefore, I think to introduce some kind of a self-policing mechanism into the accounting standard is really necessary. So therefore, I prefer approach three, and we introduce the kind of rebuttable presumption that unless you prove there is a finite intangible or finite life asset, that any payment which exceeds fair value of finite asset is regarded as overpayment. And then you have to write off immediately. So then such, if we introduce such kind of self-policing mechanism, then management may have incentive to prove what they bought and to know what they bought. And they want to estimate correctly what is the finite life of those assets. So I think we have to consider approach three with a combination of approach two.
Yes, thanks, Hans. I would like to say I think this is an extremely good paper, and I really quite enjoyed it, and I think it's covered all the pros and cons of the four approaches, and I think I broadly agree to where you've come. I know there can be lots of arguments for doing other things, but I was particularly struck by paragraph 10, which is a sort of a, I've just got to find it again. You know, when we do post-implementation reviews, I think we've got to think very seriously before we turn the standard upside down. And in this case, we've got strong views, but we've got strong views on both sides and a great diversity of views. And so if in doubt, I'd revert to status quo. I mean, you can do things like improve the impairment test and whatnot, but to go to amortization would be a very big step, and there's strong arguments for and there's strong arguments against. And so, as I say, if in doubt, I'd stay where we are as a general principle. And I was interested that Tuck likes it. Alternative three, I got down to the last point. It says, and FASB's, one of the reasons we should consider it is that FASB's considering it, and I wrote in, yes, but it's silly.
But is FASB seriously considering approach
three? I don't know.
I don't think so.
They're focusing on the amortization and looking just at the impairment test, but they haven't made a decision.
No, I don't think they're leaning towards
And there are a lot of moral hazard issues with approach three.
Moral hazard?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Another different.
You don't have to. You don't have to.
Different moral
account hazard. For your failed acquisitions anymore in the future, because it's all gone already. So you create much more moral hazard than in with the current system.
Just can I respond to? I do agree that. There might be a moral hazard unless, if we go down to the approach three, I do take your point. However, my moral hazard and my point is, does management have a sincere attitude to look through what they have bought? I mean, currently, they don't have to do that, because they can just put it.
Oh, I can see that. I can see that point.
Yeah.
Your
so
argument.
We have to incentivize.
I share that, but I think approach three is probably the worst solution.
Yeah.
Pat?
I liked a lot of what Tuck had to say. And one of the words that you used, Tuck, was rigor, and that's one of the things that I think needs to go into any kind of revision that we do here. Without necessarily hinting at where I'm leading, one of the things I think that we need to do is impose upon the reporting entity, the buyer, the need to identify what it is they think represents the basis for paying more than the fair value of the identifiable assets. In theory, they're expecting returns above normal returns. Normal returns meaning the returns you get from paying for these net assets at their fair value. So you're going to get something above fair value. Okay. Now, if they believe that, the question is over what time horizon do they think they're actually going to get these abnormal or above normal returns? There's got to be some rigor on that whole process, because they're making an assertion, and to the point that Hans is making, you want to hold management accountable to a business decision. And it may be a sound decision, but it should be transparent as to what they're thinking. Right now, there's not a lot of transparency here. The other major, I think, concern with goodwill is similar to what we had in the impairment project, is a lot of people look at this as too little, too late in terms of the measurement process. So an impairment-only process or approach, I think, has that major drawback. So unless it's more robust, I would be reticent to go in that direction. But it's possible we could really
improve more robust?
The impairment assessment.
Yeah.
If we just had just an impairment assessment. So I think this is a great opportunity, I think, to really improve an area of accounting that, as Tak mentioned, is a very sensitive area for all industries, not just, say, financial services or a particular sector that's gone through difficult times, where we've seen a kind of slow response to the accounting relative to economic conditions. So I would like to see some of that thinking go into this, and we've done some of this thinking already in some other projects, whether it's impairment, insurance, revenue, where we're imposing upon management to be more forward looking, and ultimately then make that transparent in their analysis. So I think at the end of the day, a better outcome here is going to be something that is going to combine amortization and impairment. And the reason I say that is I look at the speed with which businesses are changing. And I used the example yesterday of the iPhone. The iPhone didn't exist 10 years ago, right? So if you're putting a value on Apple 10 years ago versus an evaluation today, it would be a completely different kettle of fish, right? And I think having just an impairment-only approach suffers from that. You're making the assertion that this goodwill could go on forever potentially, and I think that's or it's not going to change significantly, and I think that's a major drawback to an impairment only approach.
Wade Wolf.
My lenient is 1+2. The reason is as Patrick said, impairment only were not workable. And this is a typical case, we cannot rely on assumption everybody will follow principle-based standards well. And a lot of empirical research already approved this. And I also don't think, C, alternative approach 3, will be good enough to punish management. Based on my observation in the history, this might be the best alternative for business and management. And by the end, the market will not criticize the management. The management will say, it's not my fault, not my fault. It's because the accounting standard asked me to write off against any reserve. And actually, both from the entity's point of view and from investment point of view, it may be the best way to do so. It's because write-off will reduce the net asset. And then the further, any amortization, of any other assets will be reduced. The earnings in the coming years will significantly increase. So this might be the best choice, and without any, the constraints of business behavior, the many behavior. And everybody happy, as I said. And I noticed one case in Hong Kong, the number one, tycoon, during the previous, the financial crisis, and buy a mobile phone company at a huge premium. And then by the year end, right off about 100 billion Hong Kong dollar. And everybody happy, and accounting firm also feel very happy because
without any burden, the accounting standards require me to do so. Of course, amortization method is not, will not have a strong, you know, the conceptual basis, but at least, you know, better than the other, you know, the worst things. So I would feel, you know, the amortization plus try to identify as many identified assets as possible may be the best choice. But only critical question to ask is whether the standard setter should set a quantitative benchmark, say 10 years in many countries, in China, you know, the same. The maximum is 10 years. And in the history, as I remember, the American standards originally amortization period is 40 years because in that period, the business entity are mainly manufacturing oriented. So 40 years, it might be appropriate. But actually, you know, I once...
40 years could never be appropriate. Any manager that goes into the market, I expect to recoup my investment in 40 years from now, it would be a laughing stock.
Yeah, I tell you the true story about how they come out 40 years. I had a discussion with a former APP chairman about 25 years ago, you know, Gary Welch.
Must be a very old man.
He died already. Oh, died already. He said...
We can't verify the story.
Yeah. But he said, this is so-called the general accepted accounting standards. He said, how can we get 40 years? The chairman said, can we vote? Start from 100 years. By the end, 40 years got... two-thirds of the votes of the board members, said this is generally accepted, you know. Okay, so my position is amortization, but the key question is, should we set a quantitative number? In my view, it doesn't matter.
Why? Well,
this is the key question.
And then allow 40 years... amortization.
No, I don't think in modern society we're not.
Oh, but they will, if we don't set a limit, they will abuse it to the hilt. Yeah.
No, I will not expect. I will not expect.
Oh yes,
so.
Absolutely.
Okay, if that is the case, we can set a quantity of the number.
Amaru.
Thank you, Hans. So I was starting saying that it's an excellent paper as well. As Ian had mentioned, I think it brought all the main aspects of the result of the post-implementation review. You were asking if we have an initial preference. I think before saying that, you know, IFRS 3 is relatively new. This is the result of post-implementation review, and my sense of all discussions that I've been involved with and reading the papers, the dichotomy between amortization and the new impairment requirement on IFRS 3, in my view, is natural. It's the natural result of applying a relatively new accounting requirement to a piece of literature in accounting that has been around for almost ever, I would say, in modern accounting. So accountants, preparers, regulators even, they feel much more comfortable with amortization because they can set 40 years. In Brazil, it's 20 years. In some other countries, it can be 10 years, and they feel much more comfortable. So I think this is natural. What made me feel comfortable is that there is at least a significant portion that do agree with the impairment. The other significant portion that doesn't agree, I could say, well, that's normal behavior. So I think in terms of, I disagree with Weigu, I think conceptually impairment in this case is stronger than amortization. Amortization will need to set a time frame necessarily. I don't foresee how we can go back to amortization without setting a time frame. And I believe IFRS 3 and the requirement for impairment was a significant improvement to what we had before. So, of course, we have to be open to what we have heard. That said, I would initially be inclined to seek for improvements in the impairment test that we have required today. And that said, I have two questions to you. One is that regarding FASB. So in paragraph 8, you remind us that, of course, FASB has not made a decision yet, but the initial perception of you staff is that they would potentially explore a simplified impairment test, is option D in paragraph 7, or amortization with impairment, as in B. Amortization together with impairment is not one of the approaches that you are identified. So it would be you are ruling this out, or you do think this would be explored because we had some interaction with the FASB. This is the first question. The second question is in paragraph 10, when you bring this notion, I think this paragraph is very important for us for our deliberation today. We remind us that there are stronger views on subsequent accounting for goodwill on stakeholders in general. But do we have a perception about users' feedback on this? I would be very interested in this particular aspect. And I read the paper twice, and I might have missed it, but I didn't see any particular reference to users' feedback.
Well, with regards to the second question, there are, in the appendix, we've taken some of the detail from the post-implementation review report and the comment letter analysis. So that has details of what users have said in there. And there are some users that would support bringing back the amortization model. And again, there are others that think that it provides no useful information, and they're against it. So there are very mixed views among
the
users.
So even users are mixed, because I always heard that users think it's rubbish, amortization.
Well, generally we've heard it that they often think it provides limited information, but again, we are hearing that they do think that some users think that the impairment test isn't providing very much information, or it's providing the information too late, and therefore they do support an amortization.
So just then to confirm, when you mentioned stakeholders in paragraph 10, we are referring to all, including users.
Yeah, I think it's pretty very mixed responses across the board on the appropriate approach. With regard to your question on the FASB, I think I understood it. I think that their leanings are either looking towards developing an amortization approach with impairment, or not considering bringing back amortization, but looking at ways of improving the impairment test. So those are the two ones I think that they're focusing on at the moment. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, you know, in your four approach, and you asked us to have to potentially indicate any initial preference, and in any of them you combine amortization with impairment.
Yes.
And my question is, are you ruling out this, or if we do understand, would be interesting to have together approach 1 and 4, so would be impairment with amortization. Do you think this is a way forward as well, or you?
I think they are looking at both. So I think if they are considering ways of amortization, but I don't think if they went down that route, they'd rule out any changes to their impairment test. I think they're looking at both of those, so they could potentially consider them together.
Martin.
Yeah. And I agree with staff has said in paragraph 70. The staff thinks that the underlying problem is a need to improve the way the impairment test is applied to ensure that impairment of goodwill are being properly recognized. I totally agree to that. But I'm really not convinced that we can really improve the impairment test in a way that goodwill is properly accounted. And why I do think so? Because what I have seen in my life kind of acquisitions was most of them was regarding integrating an acquired business to an existing business,
And if you're doing that, I think then you have this test on a on this combined cash generating unit, and then really you're combining existing goodwill with newly acquired goodwill, and that is then based on what is the existing goodwill, how high is that, then it determines when the impairment is. So I think this overall model, I think it is the only conceptual how you can do it, but it will not end up into the measurement of the goodwill which is acquired. That is a big problem. And that is the main reason, I think, why people think, okay, they would with the impairment test think how successful this acquisition of this was, but I don't think so, because you cannot measure it in isolation. Secondly, I think the problem is because man, all this kind of impairment testing is based on what the business is thinking, what is future cash flows. And it is not done in the finance or the accounting department. You have to rely on really how the business is planning future results, and that is always optimistic, always optimistic. And especially in times when there's an acquisition, because you have to defend an acquisition, why you have planned revenue synergies, cost synergies. Maybe you can track cost synergies, but revenue synergies you can never track. And therefore, I think in the first maybe 5 to 6 years, business has to be optimistic because you defend really the acquisition. But you have to, I think the impairment test is has to be, I think, relied as a basis is of this business plans. And therefore, always the impairment is too late. And as I said, my first problem was, okay, it is really not measuring the acquired goodwill. And therefore, I think it is not possible really to to properly recognize or account for this goodwill. And therefore, I think I'm with Pat, maybe we have to need a combination of amortization plus an impairment test. Because I think, totally agree, if it would be able to really improve it in a way that my problems which I have addressed could be solved. But also on your paper 16B, I think I'm not so confident that we really can improve the goodwill impairment test to resolve this kind of problems.
Can I just ask one question? Both of Mara and Martin have referred to amortization plus impairment, but I thought that was always the case. I don't think anybody's just proposed amortization without impairment.
Yes, you're right, you know.
So, you know, when we talk about amortization, it's automatically.
It's about adding amortization.
Yes.
But Ian, and it wasn't clear to me from the paper whether that amortization is still an annual amortization, sorry, the impairment is an annual impairment test or some kind of trigger event, which, and it just isn't clear which of those, when we talk about it.
You could fiddle around with that too. Philippe.
Thank you. I also think it's a good paper, but I think there is one dimension which the staff could have explored or could explore further. Is the form of consideration used for paying the acquisition of any importance? During my years as an enforcer, and I think my observation of the market since those years have not changed my conclusion, management is much more savvy when paying cash on acquisition or when using debt as compared to when they use the shares of the acquirer to make the acquisition. All the big bubbles have been on share for share exchanges, not really on cash payments or debt payments. Sometimes it's a combination of cash and equity, but most of the time, when there is an equity payment, this is where you find the big overpayments and you find the big subsequent write-offs. Why? Because it's so easy to use the company's unrecognized goodwill as an exchange for the goodwill of the target. And what happens is not just a dilution of the existing shareholders. And they have no ways to prevent many times this kind of transactions. They can vote with their feet afterwards, but on the moment, there is nothing they can do to prevent management overpaying using the equity as company. So I think I would draw two conclusions from that fact finding. And maybe we could explore further whether there is academic evidence or whether analysts could confirm this kind of findings. When you have an acquisition paid with shares issued by the acquirer, that for me would trigger two possible conclusions. Either the goodwill of the entity which acquires, which is recognized through this acquisition, should be written off.
Should be?
Written off, because why not permit to recognize the self-generated goodwill on a standalone basis, and suddenly when you have an acquisition, this creates goodwill because you acquire a company. So maybe one conclusion would be to say, this kind of goodwill is offset against equity. You create equity and then you reduce it. Or, maybe less stringent, maybe a less drastic conclusion, to use it as an indicator, a trigger, that there is possibly more risk of an impairment in those situations, and to require a more stringent impairment test when the acquisition has been paid in form other than cash or debt instruments.
Do you think that would introduce any kind of a moral hazard, though, in terms of structuring? So
There is today a big moral hazard today. There is a huge moral hazard today.
I don't disagree, but
I think that would reduce the moral hazard. Whether it would introduce another one, I'm not sure. But I think that if management know that they have to be more serious about justifying the price through an impairment test when they pay with issuing shares, maybe there would be less moral hazard. But do you agree with me that cash payments usually are less likely to create an overpayment?
No. In the leveraged buyout arena, the amount of let's just say this: in certain acquisition arenas and in certain environments, I think the availability of credit, okay, essentially makes these kind of exorbitant purchase prices very feasible.
That may be more true today because credit is cheap and credit is abundant. But there is some mitigating factors. You have some rating agencies which maybe will, the fear that the rating agency might react either with the rating is something which people consider. But I think my observations are more at a time when the credit was maybe more expensive. And people were a bit more hesitant to use credit to leverage the buyouts. But still, I think that even though today using shares is so easy, I mean, you just have to tell the market it will be a wonderful acquisition, plenty of synergies, and the share price goes up. And then
Gary.
Thank you. I'll start by joining the others, the very well-written papers, Michelle, nicely balanced and thoughtful. I think if I could only get one outcome out of all this work, I would go for the simplified impairment test. That's if I could only get one outcome. But I have my doubts about how realistically simple we can make it. Particularly cash generating units and, as Martin pointed out, companies acquire and you start integrating and you lose visibility. I agree with some of the other comments that oftentimes the impairment only testing comes up with a too little, too late charge. And I think in the Hong Kong conference, we had some academic papers that applied that. I suspect there's others as well. And I think if you simplify the test sufficiently, you may never get a charge under impairment, which would be a concern. In any event, too little, too late in there. So what do you do? I think it brings us into half the looking, reintroducing amortization. Actually, I note your point in there that maybe not enough input has said come through the PR and elsewhere that says maybe not enough has changed to reintroduce amortization. I actually disagree with that. I think we got enough input. And if you couple that with the FASB's input in the exact same subject matter, I think we can justify doing it. It came through as the number one high priority in PIR. But if you were, I would think that would bring us to a combination of impairment and amortization. I don't know how we go about amortizing, but up to 40 years, the old way I would suggest. I would think if we're going to do more research in this direction, you start looking amortization sort of tied to the acquired process capability, which maybe it's the embedded workforce, or maybe it's the longevity of the customer base, or something like that, and is probably a realistic. Of the customer base. I mean, how, granted contracts end, but then they renew, and you have satisfied customers, that's part of the amortization of the acquired intangible. I'm not suggesting we should do that, it's suggesting we should research, and would that be a plausible way to do amortization.
Sorry, Gary, that is part, those are intangible assets that are already being...
They're being amortized. I'm saying, can we extend that to goodwill?
Okay.
That's all.
Okay.
And I think, again, if you take my supposition that it's conceivable under the impairment test, we may never write off goodwill, but I happen to believe that nothing lasts forever, and you've got to find a way to dispose of it. And there's been research done that kind of says over time, acquired goodwill becomes internal goodwill. You know, it just gets subsumed and absorbed in the operation. So, again, there's nothing else on a balance sheet that can somehow amortize or settle or go away given enough time. So I think we got to go with both directions. I don't think we can get there only at an impairment-only simplification test. The other thing is in prior life, I had three or four valuation firms that I used for acquisitions, and there's a couple of these, is they always went in with the assumption that if it's a negotiated price, the price is fair value. So I'm kind of reacting to some of the things Patrick said and others, that maybe you pay more than fair value. That's how at least the valuation firms, these are names people have heard of, if it was negotiated arm's length, you assume it's fair value and that you do not pay excess. You just, the accountants, the evaluators just can't necessarily see all the sub pieces inside of it. And if it's an acquisition of a public company, there's almost inevitably a fairness opinion that the banker's rate that goes attached as part of the backup, which would say, hey, this is a fair price for what you're getting. So,
so to answer your question, Michelle, about more information, I'd like to have more information about the investor view, so like Amaru mentioned. Because I think just relying on the letters we got to the PIR is by no means enough. I'd like to look at how investors use impairments, how they used to use amortization, because it's not that long ago that we had amortization. I'd like to see what adjustments investors make, because in our leasing project, one of the big things we looked at was the adjustments investors were making in respect of operating leases, and we saw that it was extensive, and they were doing these pro forma calculations with limited information, and we used that as one of our justifications for putting what they were doing in a rough and ready way on the balance sheet. Now, is there any evidence that investors are making adjustments to the numbers at the moment and removing the impairments or adding in goodwill amortization? Is there any evidence that companies are doing non-GAAP adjustments, maybe to increase, to introduce amortization? Maybe in segment reporting, there are some companies out there that are using their own measures of performance, which include goodwill amortization. So I think we should look for evidence that there is a demand for a different system. I think there are a number of ways that we could do that. I agree with Ian that it should be a high hurdle to change. I agree with the comments that have been made criticizing impairment, Martin and Gary. And if there was one thing that I would do, if you want leanings, I would go for the improvement to the impairment test. I certainly wouldn't go for the amortization. But maybe when we see what the investor views are, I might change that opinion. I don't know. I haven't.
Is that opportunistic?
I don't think I'll be changing my opinion, because I think I know what the outcome of the research on investors will be.
Yeah,
but
that's what I wonder. If we're going to ask the staff to do work there, then know what the outcome will be.
Well, we can also speak to the FASB staff have done some outreach in the last couple of years with stakeholders about this, so we could also speak to them. And I believe the research group that we mentioned in the paper, the research group of individuals, have also think of that.
Okay, but we can help some people. Yeah.
There was one thing else I was going to say. The immediate write-off approach and the write-off against equity, you know, used to be a UK GAAP method, the recommended approach. And there was a lot of attraction to that, because goodwill is special, and it's not really like any other asset of the business. But then again, you have paid good money for it, and whether it's an equity consideration or cash, I think it's the same. And we do need to hold management to account for that investment that has been made. So eliminating it against equity just doesn't seem appropriate. But surely there are perhaps other ways of avoiding all of the problems of the amortization and impairment and still trying to hold management to account and recognizing the thing. And there used to be a method that was talked about many years ago, this dangling debit approach. And I've always felt that there was something in that. I know it's ridiculed, but what it does is that it puts it on the balance sheet, but it doesn't call it an asset, essentially. And you hold management to account, you can see the cumulative investment that's been made, but we don't have this awkward difficulty of doing the asset accounting. So I just think that there maybe is something we're missing.
So hand in, no impairment, no amortization?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think when the dangling debit was used, there was an impairment test as well, actually. Because it was presented as a deduction from equity, not as an asset. And then I think on disposal, it was sort of recycled back into the disposal gain or loss. And then the follow-on from that was...
But was it ever used, dangling debit? You're describing method as though it was in a standard. I can't ever recall it being used.
Well, in a way, it wasn't that far off what was required in US GAAP, in UK GAAP after UITF3, because they brought in recycling at that point. And so then there were disclosure requirements. I'm not sure if it was on the face, but there were certainly disclosure requirements and an impairment test.
Yeah, there was a recycling from equity when there was a disposal, but I didn't recall there being an impairment test.
My recollection of its use in UK GAAP was that it would sometimes be presented within equity as a separate debit component.
That's my recollection as well.
And then with the recycling, for sure.
Right? Yeah, but it's not within equity that I'm talking about.
So,
a couple of things, and some of it similar to what Steve said. First thing that really struck me when I reread the basis for conclusions to IFRS 3 is there's no new arguments. It's all the same stuff that the board considered in the past is being raised again, which reinforced my view that we should be hesitating before we do anything too drastic, particularly given how new IFRS 3 is. And my slight concern with that, I certainly have that view, which the staff seem to have, and I've heard others express it, but I know we want to work with the FASB, and it would be great if we got to the same place. I'm not sure I've heard them express that same sort of thinking that there's a solid anchor of today and it would take a bit to move. I'm not sure they have the same perspective. But
So one point that I remember when they were here was the dual convergence. So they'd like to remain converged with us, but they also want to do the private company thing, which
so I think they're
now
in a slightly different
amortization.
Place.
So
yeah, I think they're in a tricky place.
Different pressures.
Then what I wanted to talk about a little bit was sort of the investor view, which is similar to what Steve was talking about. Because what strikes me when you look at what investors have said is the academic literature review told us that they think there's information content and impairment. The FASB paper that they brought us last month also said that when they spoke to investors, they'd said that there was information content and impairment. But they also, I think, went on and said, and it wasn't so much the amount of the impairment, it was the fact that there was an impairment. And that made me think that maybe the information that people are looking at is a bit more nuanced than the sorts of debit and credit type focus that we've got. And we're so focused on should it be impaired, should it be amortized, and we know that people, I think, add back the amortization anyway. What is the information investors think that they want to understand about goodwill, and why is impairment useful, even though they know that it comes with sort of health warnings attached to it, and even though they might be skeptical of the amounts? There's something they're trying to understand that, and if we could understand better what it is they're trying to get at, which I suspect might be, why was an excess paid? What was it that the management thought they were getting from it? And then, is what they thought they were going to get being delivered, which might be what they're trying to get from the impairment. And maybe if we understood that better, it would help us not only think about this whole debate about amortization versus impairment, but also do we need to take a little bit of a step back too, in the same way that we have in the sort of debt equity project, where we're looking not just at the sort of bright line between debt and equity, but what other sort of presentation and disclosure type tools have we got that would help us get the right information set, instead of looking at one tool for the answer for everything? And I just wonder whether if we spent some more time talking to investors about what it is they're trying to understand, it might help us give a better steer.
I must say, I am going back and forth on this issue. I've read a couple of articles on the origins of the current proposals, as they originated in the United States. And that indicates that there is a lot of moral hazard around this issue. And I agree with Tuck in that respect. I related before, there was a sort of a, you know, tit for tat with the preparers. Pooling of interest would be abolished. In exchange, they would get non-amortization of goodwill. And I recently read an as yet unpublished article in which it was also clear this was very much advocated by the big investment banks in the United States, perhaps their acquisition and merger departments. So there is a moral hazard there. And I also think that there is a where I have a conceptual problem is that there is an unlevel playing field between autonomous growth and growth through acquisitions, and which doesn't, you know, which distorts the bottom line of two different kinds of companies. And that is what worries me. I think there's a conceptually strong case for goodwill to be amortized. And I agree with all of those who say you cannot find an objective way of doing so, but we can also not find an objective way of pairing in any reasonable manner. And I do think that it could be formulated in such a way that it could be a little bit self-policing, in the sense that we require company to make an assessment of the period in which they anticipate to recoup their investment, and that should be the basis for the amortization. And then no self-respecting CEO will say, well, that's 40 years. It would make themselves look completely ridiculous. And I think if we would do it, you would have to put, you know, maximum around 10 years or so. So if we look at what investors used to take out, I'm sure they took it always out because it was a non-cash item. But I'm not always impressed by what investors or analysts take out or add on. And also, we should not forget that there are a lot of investors who only look at the bottom line and who do not make adjustments. And that's a much larger group than what we think. So that all leads me in the direction of reinstating amortization, but then again, I am also very sensitive to all these arguments which against making a major standard, change in the standard that is so recent, and that will, you know, will upset half the world, and it will be a major change, and people are, you know, think we make too many changes to begin with. Also, the fact that whatever we do, there is not a clear-cut solution, which I think, you know, for leases, what we have done is really clear-cut. But with this, it will never be clear-cut. So that's where I, you know, I'm skeptical of making such a big step. If we could start from a blank page, I think I would go for amortization. But making this change, that's really worth it. Changwu.
Thank you. I would like to suggest there is another very nice paper on similar issue. The John Brown's the paper. She's analyzing the new definition of conceptual framework of liability and asset on the issue of the of IAS 37. I think her analysis may be very useful in analyzing this issue, even though this is a very nice paper, you can add more improvements. Based on her analysis, is she supported the current existing requirements, IAS 37, even their symmetric treatment on content, maybe some assets and liabilities. The reason why he suggested is uncertainty of timing and amount of cash flows. So all provisions, contingent liabilities, some assets are very, very uncertain. That's why she decided, her conclusion is a symmetric prudence might be optimal on this IAS 37, even though we introduce new concept of a liability on assets. So that's the one suggestion to think about this issue. And I agree with many people who have suggested that I prefer a kind of a symmetric prudence on this issue. So maybe the approach one, amortization might be a very good idea. You know, even though we don't want any drastic change from the very new, quite new, the accounting standard. Based on the, such kind of a logic, and maybe very useful. And on the Steve's comment on investors, there was a kind of academic research on, in the Hong Kong Research Forum. There was a paper, they used the analyst, very professional analyst, to think about what they think on the information of goodwill amortization or impairment. Interestingly, these are very experienced analysts, but they just respond very mechanically. They didn't have any adjustment at all. Just responding the final bottom number of earnings, if they are bigger, then they put on some value bigger on those companies. But maybe some sophisticated analysts might adjust some numbers of the presented on the maybe balance sheet or income statement. But generally, based on this experiment study, the analysts do not adjust. They are relying on our numbers based on the IFRS's general. That's another comment. And another thing is, if we accept this kind of amortization approach, and we also need a kind of some very prudent approach on the useful life of the goodwill, because there is no answer which life is the correct one, but we should introduce the same concept of prudence on the useful life too. If we do introduce such kind of concept, then we don't need any more detailed computation, so we don't have to introduce customer relationship as another intangible asset. That's another big issue that many investors ignore, the amount of a customer relationship on the balance sheet. So, you know, that is so resolve such kind of an issue. Another thing is impairment. Simplification of impairment test is not aligned with this issue, I guess. We need more complex, more finer impairment test to make a precise amount of the amount of this goodwill is impaired. So simplification is going in the other way against the current position problem. But however, if we introduce this amortization approach, maybe it's okay. Simplified impairment test, maybe it's okay, because we don't need any rigorous impairment test at all. As Martin has just said, you know, it's quite difficult to make a complex impairment test. We need any kind of simplification. So everything, the simplification of the impairment test and computation and the useful life issue, based on the joint analysis, if we need sometimes very prudence, so because of the uncertainty of the timing and amount catch.
Daryl?
So starting point is, I agree with what Sue said about in reading the paper, and I think it is a good paper, but in reading the paper, it's hard to find anything that doesn't feel like it's been discussed before. It's hard to see anything that jumps out as brand new. So start with the point of saying I think we're rehashing an old argument rather than trying to create a completely new argument. In terms of thinking about the starting point for me would always be the impairment test, because that's where we are right now. I would agree with what both Martin and Gary said, that I think we're going to find it very difficult to simplify the impairment test. And that's because of the things that we're mixing in here, old and new, purchased and non-purchased, the muddling up of the actual businesses post an acquisition, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult to do that. And for that reason, I think to the extent that we're going to talk about this, I'd be very interested in better understanding how the trigger process would work. Because that is one form of simplification that doesn't talk to the mechanism of the test, but simply how frequently you have to do the test. And I think that would at least make me, at least is one option of thinking about it. Because of that, I'm inclined towards amortization. I think amortization is something we do need to discuss quite seriously. I would be very anti the suggestion here that people have around the idea of actually putting a cap on the period. And I liked very much what Pat said, together with a little bit what Gary was saying. I think when business sits down and decides to pay a particular price, they have valuations at hand, they have an understanding of what they're buying, they have an understanding of why they're paying a particular price. I think there's information content in getting into that understanding, and I think there's a lot of information content in understanding what management thinks the payback period is of that. And actually reflecting that amortization over the period of the payback period makes a lot of sense to me. I think also there's a second part to amortization, which is essentially in a business acquisition, you are buying excess returns. Allowing those excess returns to live as a credit in your income statement without any debit, I think misrepresents the performance of the entity. So I think having both the debit and the credit in place makes sense to me, along with the idea, as I say, that management needs to have specified or thought about the period of time. In terms of the direct write-off, I don't support the direct write-off. I don't think it makes sense for a lot of the reasons that people have spoken about. But I do agree with your idea that it's something that we should talk about, if only because of the point I think Philippe was making. Is very often there is reason to have an impairment at inception because of overpayment. And I think the fact that we talk about direct write-off might lead us to think a little bit more about that at inception write-off. And perhaps just encourage that, perhaps through the impairment process.
Mary?
First, and most important, support for the staff's recommendation about our strategy and approach on this, that even if we develop a preference for a view to try and get up to speed with the other alternatives that the FASB is considering so that we are in a position to make an informed decision, yes or no, once we have information from them about which way they're leaning. And so I think that's the right strategy. Well, personally, I favor the approach for I don't want to cut off the other discussions and say we won't consider them and then be forced with a, you know, do we have a basis for not to be left without an ability to engage meaningfully with the FASB if they go in a different direction? And I think, for as an example of both something that we should bring to the table and the kind of thinking we should be doing, I do not support the direct write-off. I think in a consideration of direct write-off, some of the points that we could contribute to discussion include the thinking that we've done in IAS-1 with the change that says you don't book anything directly to equity if it's not a transaction with shareholder. And just as an example, also in terms of the potential for write-off against but through comprehensive income, thinking about the work we've been doing, the conceptual framework, and do we really believe that passes the threshold that we have proposed, not finalized, but proposed, about enhancing the relevance of P&L as a measure of performance. So those are things I think we should be able to contribute, and so we should get ready and get up to speed and then participate in those discussions, even if we don't favor them. I share Ian's approach of Ian's presumption of not wanting to make a change if there's not a proven case. And, you know, I pick up part of what Daryl said in terms of it does feel more like a rehash of old arguments than new data being put in front of us. And I found it ironic that the same argument about internally generated goodwill replacing purchase goodwill is used to support both the argument of why you need amortization and why amortization distorts the performance statement. You know, it was deployed by both views, so I think we're getting into a lot of logic and, you know, debating rather than facts. And back to Steve's point about more outreach, and you, I think, I can't remember where Hans, whether it was you or somebody else, said, well, let's not send the staff on a wild goose chase if we don't expect them to find something. But sometimes going out and finding nothing is actually evidence that we have to consider about, you know, where the demand is and how things are being used. So I don't think it's a wild goose chase to do that work to see if we can get the kind of insights Sue was talking about. So further comments on some of the impairment improvements, but I think probably best held to the next paper.
Thank you. I respect what Hans mentioned. You are afraid of significant change. But what I'm suggesting is not a significant change. The combination of approach 2 and 3 is already in the current standard. And if you read carefully BC, it says actually it assumed the goodwill was quite narrow, and overpayment itself must be an expense. So then, in this sense, the idea of approach 2 and 3 is already incorporated in the current standard. But what is missing is we didn't have a self-policing mechanism. So then, as Sue said, everything is written in the BC. However, we didn't talk about self-policing mechanism. That is what I'm saying is default was asset. If there is a residual, then default would be asset. So then, that's rather self-policing. It is not a self-policing mechanism at all. It is rather incentive to the moral hazard. So actually, without self-policing mechanism, there would be huge tension between auditor and preparers, because we don't know what is the goodwill all about. And if we discuss we should amortize, we don't know what we are amortizing. Even if we discuss impairment, we don't know what is the thing you think it's impaired. That's why the discussion would be so much complicated. But if we introduce a self-policing mechanism and put the default as an expense, then if we leave it in practice, it would work. And
so profit and loss.
Yeah, that depends on the argument with Philip. And then we have to discuss it later. But let me talk about moral hazard issue you mentioned. There is two types of moral hazard. So one moral hazard is caused by impairment only mechanism. The other moral hazard is caused by write-off mechanism. But the big difference between two moral hazard is one moral hazard has a transparency as a net asset basis. So if you go down the write-off basis, at least you have a much transparent net asset than the impairment-only moral hazard. So that's why I'm leaning toward approach 2 and 3. Of course, many Japanese support approach 1, but I was wondering, approach 1 address the moral hazard or not, because it's nearly impossible to define what is the correct amortization period.
Gary?
Yeah. Thank you. Just handful of quick miscellaneous thoughts that occurred to me, you know, as other people were talking. But clearly, I think the going to the amortization was very tightly tied to the elimination of pooling of interests, at least on, you know, the other side of the pond. It absolutely was. It was fiercely debated, and I think that was, for lack of a better word, a concession in it. In fact, I can remember prior to that, and by the way, against my preference, but I wasn't senior enough, is writing comment letters not only defending pooling, but why it should be made easier to qualify. The debate was really an intense debate, and I think the amortization was part of the wrap-up of it. If you want to do some deep ancient history, prior to APB 17, which came out about 1968, goodwill was tested for impairment. It was not amortized at that time. I don't know the AICPA's thought process to go from impairment to amortization, but it sounds very similar, you know, to the discussion we're having here. Now, that's a different error, but that's also the error the big conglomerates were built at, in the world, many of whom have been since disbanded. But just a thought, if we want to kind of follow the deep history of this project, because someone said, there's nothing new in any of this stuff. This has been around forever, you know, the issues inside of here. I actually don't support the direct write-off method, whether it's direct equity through OCI or through P&L, or all kind of get the same result. And it's not that it doesn't have some appeal, but I think it's 100% contrary to management's assertion, who presumably in good faith, with knowledge and negotiation, paid what they think the company was worth. That's the problem, to my way of thinking on that. And I think we talk about, you know, the fair value the company bought and the excess should paid. I think we're in the M&A world. I think there's two fair values. There's sort of the trading day-to-day value in the stock price. But you go to try to acquire a company, the world it's automatically 20% higher than that, or some number. It might vary by industry. So I think there's two fair values that that exist. And I think an acquisition is a different paradigm, you know, than sort of day-to-day, you know, independent trading.
So Hans, I wanted to comment on what you said earlier about organic growth and acquisition-related growth and the distortion to the bottom line. I agree that the accounting for investment that creates organic growth and the investment that creates acquisition growth is different. But capitalizing goodwill and amortizing it isn't going to resolve that difference, because you get the amortization in a different period. You prospectively amortize the amount you've invested, whereas in a company that's organically grown, what was invested in the past is already gone. So I think it's the exact opposite, that you create a distortion to the bottom line as a result of goodwill amortization. And the evidence, I think, is the feedback we get from investors over the existing intangibles that are recognized in a business combination. Because effectively, we do have what I would regard as goodwill capitalization amortization at the moment. It's just partial, because many of the intangibles, I think we recognize too many intangibles, not too few as tech things. I think we recognize too many intangibles in a business combination, and that effectively what is goodwill is partially capitalized and amortized. And investors constantly complain about the amortization that's already there, which is the amortization of these existing intangibles, because they say it distorts the bottom line. So that's why I think capitalizing more will further distort the bottom line.
Okay, well, you need to explain it further to me, but we can do that outside this meeting.
Yes, Stephen? I want to start with a point about PIRs, because we're about to start a handful next year. And I guess I think it's very awkward to fundamentally change a conceptual conclusion that the board has relatively recently reached as a result of a PIR. And that's why I'm strongly with Sue that we should not move much. I think it just sends a difficult signal. I'm much more in the camp, and I'm sure one can have different views on this, but I'm much more in the camp that PIRs should be about practical implementation issues, which is why I think trying to find improvements to impairment testing ticks that box. Steve made a point earlier on about non-GAAP adjustments and whether companies make non-GAAP adjustments in respect of amortization. At least I think that's what you were suggesting. But there was an academic paper that I looked at last week in Hong Kong. I don't recall any such adjustments being made. So I think that is quite an interesting market indicator, if you like. On the point of what is it the investors are looking for, surely they're looking for signals on whether or not the acquisition has been successful. An impairment, whether or not it's late, sends that signal. And therefore, I think it is powerful. And I actually think we got that from the PIR work that was done. And I also think we got a message from investors that arbitrary amortization adjustments over arbitrary periods is simply not helpful and simply not reflective of any economic reality whatsoever. So I come back to the notion that we should stick with trying to find simplifications to the impairment test, but I also acknowledging that it's actually quite hard because we don't really know what goodwill is. But that would be my default position at this point. I quite like the point, I think it was Steve made, that because we don't quite know what it is, and sometimes it represents an overpayment by overzealous top management, some kind of qualitative thing in the middle might be interesting to explore, but I don't have any immediate suggestions.
Can I challenge what you just said?
There were a couple of people
okay.
Who
wanted to. Yeah, I wanted to act maybe the same way.
We don't know what
not talk about the academic literature, you're right, but just look at the pharma industry over the last 10 years. It's probably the industry where there has been the biggest wave of mergers and acquisitions. And I think that in most cases, post-acquisition, the company has made some non-GAAP adjustments to highlight the effect of the business combination on IPRD, on inventories, etc. Also look at the contracting industry, look at companies which have long-term contracts of maintenance, of nuclear reactors, of aircraft engines, all make non-GAAP adjustments. I do not draw a conclusion that our accounting is bad. I would rather draw a conclusion that this information is useful to investors to know how the subsequent reporting is affected by the business combination. I would draw a conclusion that we should highlight, disclose better, and it was told at the meeting we had with investors in Brussels, was it you were present? There was clearly a demand for having a better understanding of the impact of the business acquisition on the subsequent reporting. I will not change our accounting on that basis. I would say maybe let's disclose the impact.
Yeah, 2 points. The first, I'm not agree with you, any big changes we should have after PRR. And we never say the PRR, consequent to the PRR, will only have minor changes. We never say so, But we say PRR will not naturally trigger any changes.
I wouldn't say they should always be minor. I'm just saying it's awkward to change a conceptual decision that the board has long deliberated.
Mm-hmm. Not related to PR. I agree with you. But we never say PR will not trigger big changes. We say PR will not necessarily trigger changes. And secondly, Kaka, I not agree with you, but on the basis of different slightly from Steve. Steve challenged the usefulness to capitalize more. I will challenge you the feasibility to capitalize more. Because the idea of a goodwill is you pay the more for the excess profitability, which is not be able to attributable to any identified asset. But what you want to say is, let's try my best to capitalize as we can. But
that is not what I'm saying. I'm saying is, actually, in the current standard, it says you have to identify the assets you bought. Sorry.
The world is not hearing your contribution. So that's the punishment for
AI. Shall I push it again?
Yeah, now leave it.
Okay, just talk.
Sorry. What I'm saying is, in current standard, first thing you have to do is you have to look through what you bought, and you have to identify what you bought. And if it's if it has a finite life, then you have to amortize it. That is the basic idea. And if there is a residual, then it could be either overpayment or asset, which is a goodwill. But what this standard intended was, goodwill cannot be such a large amount of asset. Goodwill should be something quite narrow or small.
Right.
And that everything else could be overpayment. And standard clearly said overpayment should be an expense in the first place. But it's difficult to identify. That's what the standard, then full stop. Then, if we leave it to the practice, this gives a very bad incentive to keep it as big as possible, and then delay the impairment. That is what is happening. So this standard does not have a self-policing mechanism. That is my point. So then why don't we introduce a self-policing mechanism so that the residual has a rebuttable presumption that is an expense. And then if you prove this has a finite life asset, then you can amortize it based on that the finite lives you prove. If we introduce such kind of self-policing mechanism, I don't think we have to worry about huge tension between auditor and preparers because it has self-policing mechanism. That is my point.
I just wanted to make two observations. One, when you said that we don't know what goodwill is, I think that's actually one of the critical issues and what I was trying to drive towards. I think we need to force management to make goodwill more transparent. So demonstrate, if you're going to pay X amount in excess of the fair value of the net assets, tell us what you're attributing your excess purchase price to. Over what horizon do I expect to actually earn those abnormal or excess returns? And in doing so, now you have essentially the period over which you might be looking at, to consume goodwill. And if those assumptions aren't emerging, right out of the box, then you know whether or not you have an impairment. Today, it's a big black box.
Yeah, but
and there's no accountability around this.
I hear what you're saying, but I think that it overlooks the behavioural consequence or the behavioural things that are going on, especially in situations where two companies are competing with each other.
Yeah, but this is done in every acquisition. As a management, management goes to roadshows, really saying why they're paying more than maybe the sum of the fair value of the assets. Man, they're disclosing synergies, cost synergies, everything. I think that is transparency.
No, but they don't tell you over what horizons.
They
don't tell you over what horizons and specifically. Yeah,
but how can you do that? What horizons, man? If you say, I realize cost synergies, maybe doing that in the next 2 years and forever.
But then the goodwill should be gone in the next 2 years.
Synergies will go away after 5 years. Or revenue synergies will go away after 6 years? And this is dreamland, I really think.
You cannot
really quantify that. And you cannot measure it. You cannot say exactly what it is.
You can't measure goodwill, you're saying.
No, you can't.
So then basically I think what you're arguing is that you should just leave that debit up on the balance sheet and don't try to assess it for anything.
I think there's something in that.
I think
the implication of what you just said, Martin.
My personal view is that really, what users are doing with that, nothing.
I agree.
That in times when it was amortized, they have excluded their amortization expense from that. Currently, if it is an impairment, they're excluding that. Clearly, they're doing nothing with that. Nothing, never, never ever. That is what my experience is. So what we are doing, I think, is not of really high relevance.
Peter?
On another tack, a couple of people have said that they thought the introduction of non-amortization was some sort of trade-off for getting rid of poolings. I mean, that's not the case in IFRS. It might have been the case in US GAAP, but non-amortization was introduced here in the late 90s. And there was a long discussion then about trying to make the impairment test robust enough to be able to get rid of it. Amortization, and at the time the feeling was that impairment only was the better solution, but the concern obviously was can you make the test good enough. So that's the historical context here.
Okay, but it was
based on the reality in the United States?
No, I don't think it was. I mean, that was long before the US even started talking about it.
I think the biggest abuse of pooling was in the United States, not
here.
No.
We still have pooling at that stage, and the abolition of pooling came later, and that was part of when IFRS 3 came in.
We got rid of amortization before the US did.
All right. So where does this leave us?
What a discussion and input.
Yeah. Well, I think it was just to get a feel for where people's leanings were,
yeah.
So if there's any further information you need before talking to the FASB.
Well, I think we can safely conclude that with the exception of TAC, I don't think there's a lot of appetite for direct write-off. Right?
Well, I would write off the part which is the share of goodwill.
This is different with impairment.
Not direct write-off.
Philippe's is quite a different argument.
Yeah, this is, you know, impairment. They won't.
There was also a request for some more follow-up in terms of investor views,
yeah.
As well,
yeah.
And I think we could do that.
Even a summary of what we've got so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. We need more.
Yeah. And Hans, on your, well, I agree that there was little appetite around this table for the direct write-off. There's not none, but relatively little. I mean, I think I'd go back and say, and I don't know if others agree, that I still would like to see what the FASB has considered and where they are if they have not reached a conclusion yet to eliminate that alternative from their consideration, because I would hate to be caught out if suddenly that becomes the leading candidate and we're at zero on that.
I think the paper said that we keep track of
yes.
FASB.
Well, that's what I was saying. I think we should do that rather than
yeah.
remove it from the mix at this point, even if there's not much support here initially for that.
Hans, one thing I think, you know, we should ask the staff to do, that is, you know, whether we should set a limit or not, if we want to go through amortization road.
Yeah, I think that's a secondary question. I also think we should try to sound out among our constituents a little bit, but the fear that many of us have that we are, or the realization that we are not talking from a blank piece of paper, and that we are talking about a recently changed standard, and whether it would be appropriate for us to make a major change. I don't think we have. Have we posed that question to our constituents? That might, you know, cause people to pause.
At the other meeting, this was expressed by a few members saying, well, change again so soon.
Yeah.
But we changed subcategory for financial instruments shortly.
We don't change it every 5 years.
We don't change it every 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Main point. IAS 39, IFRS 9, 20 years.
Yeah.
More or less. IFRS 3 revised today, 6 years, 7 years.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have enough to go on?
Well, we had a second paper on looking at ways that we could improve the impairment test.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we want to have that discussion now or whether we'd rather have it with more information from outreach with users or at least the extent that we've got information available now that we could feedback from what users think about what they're getting from the information from the impairment test.
Shall we hold off on that?
Could I just flag up one thing on this paper, which is I think it focuses quite correct, well, got very, very good and accurate description of similarities, differences, you know, mechanics that might make things easier. But there's a very different underlying concept. When you're looking at some of the things that FASB is considering as simplifications that would reduce the cost, make the impairment tests easier to do, and I think with the hope that both by it both reduces the cost and by making it easier to do might improve its t- timeliness of reporting, you know, of impairments, but the whole thing with value and use and fair value less cost to dispose for IFRS, while U.S. GAAP having a single test and a single measurement does make things easier, is very different underlying concepts, with the IFRS perspective being right off that piece that isn't recoverable. And I think U.S. GAAP having, my recollection, I'm going to look particularly at Gary because of his work in this area, is that U.S. GAAP is more a notional, it's a reset to fair value because of more a notion of, it's as if I've disposed but decided to repurchase at this current fair value. And I mean, that certainly was in 121, and I think it carried over somewhat to this. And if you have such a, I mean, I think we can learn from, you know, their exploration of mechanics and what mechanics are easier. I don't think it should preclude us from thinking about things like qualitative triggers or indicators. But I think we have to remember how far apart we are on the concepts in terms of what we are trying to achieve with impairment, and just have that in mind as we look at whether things read across from us to them and them to us. And it's not that reconsidering our objective would be a bad thing, in itself, but again, that's a very significant conceptual point about what the objective of impairment is. And I think throughout our literature, it's to write off only the piece that is not recoverable rather than reset to fair value at the date of a test.
I just want to highlight in your research a point that Martin made earlier, which I completely agree with, and I think it's one of the biggest problems with the impairment test and impairment only, and that is this notion of combining what you've bought with what you currently have in the same business, and you call this a cash generating unit, and you evaluate the cash flows in the aggregate, and sometimes what you have is performing quite well, what you bought turns out not to be as good as you thought, but hence the existing goodwill offsets and more than is enough to pass the impairment test. I think this is where investors get frustrated, because they know what essentially has been operating and is performing well. What they really want to know is what you bought and where are the assumptions that you made about it sound, and did they play out the way you thought? But now it becomes opaque to them, right? Because this thing has been formed called the cash generating unit, and I can't really see what I bought, how well it's doing relative to what I had. I think that's the biggest flaw in IAS 36. So it allows management to kind of mask what's going on. And this is why I argue in defense of against what you were saying earlier. I think you can hold management to task by saying, look, what was your assumption? Here's what you laid out. This was your forecast. It's kind of like impairment. Okay, I lent money. Is the asset performing or is it not performing? You have empirical evidence to evaluate.
Mm. Gary? This is just a process question, Michelle. I'm not sure where we came out here in approach two about separating components of goodwill. But assuming we're going to do some more research on it, and paragraph 22 lays out pretty much what they would be, but the history of how we got to the identifiable assets that we're amortizing, I'd be curious as a thought process. One is there's boundaries put around them, legally separatable and can exist on their own or something like that, which that's not true of anything here in paragraph 22A. So if we dropped those two barriers and said, would we be able to value reasonably, objectively, all these things in 22A? Right now we don't, because they weren't legally separatable and from the entity that they came with. So then assuming you're going to go into 22A, and I'd be interested as to, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the evaluator's computations? I mean, what are they going to have to do? And because I'm not necessarily a fan of approach two, but if we're going to go there, that would be information I'd be interested in.
Stephen.
I agree with Pat about the problems of interpreting these impairments, and I think the solution is actually better disclosure, because I think the ultimate solution to all of this is sort of provide better information to investors. I think there is lots we could do on simplifying and reforming the impairment calculation. One thing I'd do is get rid of value in use. I just use fair value. I think if we were to look again at this in the light of IFRS 13, which of course wasn't in existence when the whole thing was done initially, I think we might get to quite a different view on it. I think that would also go down very well because of the restrictions in the value in use calculation in terms of future growth and the like. I think taking that away would be a sensible way of doing it. But ultimately, whatever we do to the impairment calculation isn't going to provide the full solution, and that's why I think disclosure is very important.
I can ask you a question. Fair value for a CGU which has no market price, which is no transactions observable, not listed, how would you do the fair value of that CGU
because all time? Because I think IFRS 13 is crafted in such a way that it deals with that. And in these situations, value in use and fair value essentially converge.
This is what I was saying.
Well, because at the moment, the way in which value in use is used is very restrictive, because you're constrained about what assumptions you can make. And I think those are artificial constraints. And that's why I think just take away value in use.
But I think that was part of the trade-off at the time of getting a rigorous, trying to get a rigorous enough test to satisfy the board at the time that it could drop the amortization requirement. So
But being rigorous, I think just curtailing something in the name of being rigorous, and you clearly then get the wrong answer, it doesn't seem to me to be a very sensible way of being rigorous.
I support value and use it, but that's not what I was going to say. I'm interested, this mentioned the EFRAG OIC ASBJ group and their research, and you say we should monitor what they've done, which I can't disagree with.
You shouldn't even read it.
Yeah, but I think we should contemplate bringing them in even closer. Now, we've had a lot of history lessons today, and in about 2004, national standards heads used to work very closely on projects, and the UK board had a member of staff in here working on leasing with the group here, for example. And that all changed when the convergence thing with the US came along, and I got a personal telephone call advising me that the UK board would not be involved anymore. There are only two standard setters in the world, and we were going to get converged, and that was that. Well, the wheels swung again.
Did you take that personally, Ian?
I didn't.
he said, I'll be back.
I just said gently, I'm not absolutely sure that's true, but
I wasn't going to win the argument.
But this looks like a good group, and I just think we should, going forward, and also in this case, think about whether we can work a bit more closely than just monitoring what they've done, because they're putting in a lot of effort. It's a good dispersed group, Japanese, Italians, Europeans, you know, all in one, and it could be a good precedent, I think, for going forward.
Can I ask one more question about what the staff could possibly look at? The little discussion that I had with Stephen about level banking between organic growth and growth through mergers and acquisitions. Would it be possible to do some simple analysis of that? I don't know. If it's true what Stephen says, would take away a lot of my anguish about the current situation. And I think would also be a strong argument out of the outside world, because I think there is a general perception that accounting-wise there is facilitates mergers and acquisitions relative to organic growth. If that's not the case, then it would be take away a lot of the implicit argumentation. Yeah. This is something that you could you know, in the national standard sets could do some work too.
Yeah. I think that's true, although I think, like with one of the earlier comments, people deploy those arguments on both sides of the debate.
Yeah.
The same fact pattern they deploy on both sides of the debate.
Yeah, okay, let's see who does it in the most convincing way. Okay, so I guess we're done.
Yes, unless anyone else has any comments on paper 18B, because it will come back in some form or another with a bit more information in it. So if anyone's got any other areas that they think need to work or...